Well, by my clock, it's the bottom of the hour, so I will say greetings all and welcome to the teleclass Patient Empowerment and Measurement Program for Hand Hygiene. My name is Paul Weber, and I am delighted that you have all joined us for this teleclass today. A special welcome to those of you who are listening to your first Weber Training teleclass. You picked a good one. Our faculty for this teleclass today is Dr. Marianne McGuckin. Dr. McGuckin, well, she does not sit still very long. She is the president of McGuckin Methods International. You'll hear more about that in a minute. She was with the University of Pennsylvania for more than three decades. She has been a senior scholar in the Health Policy Research Department at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. She's been a visiting researcher at Oxford University as well as at a university in Belgium, the name of which I won't attempt to pronounce. Dr. McGuckin serves on the CDC task force that developed hand hygiene guidelines for healthcare workers and also on the World Health Organization task force on developing a global patient empowerment model. Also, she created the Partners in Your Care program, which is a hand hygiene program that combines monitoring and patient empowerment and that is used in several hundred hospitals. She is an expert of experts, which makes her perfect for the teleclass program. There's so much more to say about this lady, not the least of which that she is a really nice person to work with. However, I'll stop rambling and let her get on with it. To present the teleclass, Patient Empowerment and Measurement Program for Hand Hygiene from Philadelphia, PA, it's my honor to present Dr. Marianne McGuckin. Marianne.
Well, thank you, and welcome to all the people that are listening to this teleclass. I'm certainly honored that you're taking the time from your schedule to do this. What I'd like to cover today is really talk to you, dialogue with you, and hopefully we'll get some questions at the end on patient empowerment and where are we going with this, and then also to introduce you to our measurement program for hand hygiene that we developed over a decade ago and how we're moving forward with this. So if you go to your second slide, just a little bit about McGuckin Methods International. Basically, this consulting organization was started in 1984 to provide education, statistical solutions, and ways of monitoring for early detection of healthcare-associated infections. As Paul has said, you know, I had been at the University of Pennsylvania as faculty and staff for over 30 years, and currently I'm president of MMI and also as an adjunct senior scholar in health policy department at Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. So, just to give you an idea of where we are, where we have been in terms of MMI's activities, and also more importantly, this graph shows you sites that have used our methodology of patient empowerment and product volume measurement as of 2008. You can see where we have been in the U.S., where we are, and there's a lot of holes in this map where we'd like to fill in. The goal of MMI in this activity, and also for myself personally, is to try to put some standardization efforts into hand hygiene measurement. We're hearing too much from ICPs out there. My compliance is 80%, my compliance is 90%, my compliance is 50%. You know, I always say to individuals, if your compliance is 90% to hand hygiene, then you should be making national news. I mean, you should be a hospital with probably zero infection rates. So we need to standardize this so that we know we're all basically covering or counting the same jelly beans. So you can see where we have clusters in this map, like, for instance, Washington State. Washington State several years ago was introduced to this program. As a statewide initiative, we're now have in our program the Oregon State Hospital Association. So all of their they're doing a pilot with us. And basically with the goal that we're trying to get states to look at this as an activity so that they can standardize what they're doing and also have comparisons not only nationally but also statewide. And you can see the code on this slide. We have various size hospitals from 25-bed critical care access hospitals to large medical centers. We offer the measurement program for long-term care, pediatric, rehab, so whatever form of healthcare delivery. On slide four, the objectives that I would like to cover during this short presentation is to be able, and I'm sure many of you can define this, but really define or identify the scientific evidence for patient empowerment. Do patients want to be empowered, whether hand hygiene or any form of healthcare? Also to introduce you to the components of our program and talk a little bit about the steps necessary to implement a program of empowerment and measurement. Patient empowerment. I always like to use this slide. In 1982, while teaching at the University of Penn, I was interviewed by Medical World News and Report and asked, what did I think was important in healthcare? And I was beginning because I had just finished being in an ICP in a hospital at Penn, to really think about this whole idea of what patients can do. And I said this quote, patients should be sure that any physician, nurse, or therapist has washed his or her hands before touching them. And the little drawing on the side was actually the brainstorm of the editor of the journal. And I had this picture in my mind for many years, wash your hands. This seemed to be the deciding point in my mind that maybe we should be thinking about involving the patient. And, of course, I like to now add to my slide that 25 years later, National Patient Safety Goal has come out with their standard about encourage active patient involvement. So I sort of see myself as 25 years ahead of the National Patient Safety Goal. And I also like to emphasize that goal wants active participation. Patient empowerment doesn't mean just giving out a brochure to someone. It means actively engaging in some type of dialogue so you're sure that the patient is empowered to do whatever they are asked to do in order to prevent some harm. So what is empowerment? If we look at the literature, and we're doing a lot of this right now, as Paul had said, I'm working with the World Health Organization, and we will be putting together a chapter in the Global Safety Challenge that the World Health will release in September of 2008, a chapter on patient empowerment. So we have reviewed many articles along these lines, and the bottom line is that a simple definition, and most of it comes from nursing journals, is a process in which clients participate with nurse facilitators to assist them to develop proactive healthy behaviors. It's a general term, but it certainly applies to hand hygiene. And again, on this slide six, you'll see that the Global Challenge will be addressing this. So what else do we know about patient empowerment? In 2006, we conducted a telephone survey across the U.S., actually hired a firm to call people, the people that call you at dinner time. And basically, what we did, we were doing this survey for one reason originally, and that was to determine what does the consumer think about mandatory reporting of hospital-acquired infections or hospital-associated infections. However, we decided to add two questions relevant to hand hygiene. One was, if your healthcare worker came into you when you were admitted and said to you, we want to encourage you to be part of our team and we expect you or we want you to remind your healthcare worker to wash their hands, would you do this? And what we found in our survey is 4 out of 5 or 80% said they would do that. We also threw in an additional question and asked, if you were hospitalized during the last year, do you remember seeing your healthcare worker put on gloves instead of practicing hand hygiene? And 52% said they saw this. And I think this brings home what we all say, that hand hygiene occurs less than 50% of the time. And the data for the rest of the survey, it was published in the American Journal of Medical Quality in December 2006. As part of this survey, I also put in some of these results to share with you, is that we asked consumers to rank 13 different factors that they consider important when choosing a hospital or a doc, and 94% said rating their hospital as clean, physically clean, was very important to them. 85% said low infection rates, and 93% said knowing infection rates for a hospital or a doctor would influence their selection. So I think we have to keep this in mind, because we know mandatory reporting is in many states, and I'm from Pennsylvania, where we probably were the first to really take an active role in this. So what is the World Health Organization doing? What we're doing as part of this global challenge and this chapter that we're putting together is we actually have put together a two-phase survey in which we have surveyed globally and also through scenarios respondents on hand hygiene practices. So on the left-hand side, this is on page 9, on this graph, we asked the people that were surveyed, if your healthcare worker asked or invited you to remind them about hand hygiene, would you feel able to do this? And you can see clearly, these are the regions of the World Health Organization, that the respondents were very high. We range from 70% to 90%. We then said to them, if your healthcare worker did not ask or invite you about hand hygiene, would you feel comfortable doing this? And you can see the percentages dropped across the globe. And finally, we asked the question, if you saw your healthcare worker taking care of a patient next to you and then coming to you without washing or sanitizing their hands, would you ask them to do so? And you can see clearly in some of the regions the percentages went up. So the message here is clearly that, you know, patients will be empowered if we as healthcare workers are empowered enough to really have a dialogue going and assuring them that this is okay. I also would like to share with you that on Friday, MSNBC did a story about dirty hands. They usually love to title it this, but several of us were interviewed about this, and we were not aware of the fact that they were going to put a question in there, and the question was simply, you know, would you feel comfortable asking your healthcare worker to wash their hands? I was just amazed at the number of respondents. And also very curious, because the data that they got out is the data that we've been showing for the last 10 years in our survey. Over close to 11,000 people responded to the survey, and what they found is that 60% said, yes, they would feel comfortable and they would do this because who else would do it? So, yes, they would respond. 20% said, no, they were concerned that it may compromise their care. And another 20% said, at this point, I'm not sure. I truly believe that 20%, if we empower them, they would be up with the 60, and it would be 80%. And we have constantly said over the last 10 years that our data shows that somewhere between 70 and 80% of people will definitely ask if they're encouraged to take part in hand hygiene practices. So if we look at slide 10, this is there's several studies that are out there that people have looked at empowerment in decision-making in various ways in certain disease processes like diabetes, cardiovascular disease. But specifically in hand hygiene, we have published 5 studies in various journals. Our first was in 1999 in the American Journal of Infection Control, and all of these studies are simple 6-week baseline intervention type studies. And we found in our acute care study, our first one, which was a multi-center study of 4 hospitals, we found that within 6 weeks, by just introducing the intervention of patient empowerment, we were able to increase hand hygiene by 34%. Our second study was done in the UK at Oxford Hospital, at JR Hospital in Oxford. And what we found there, that is, we took the model over there, and we found, again, in a 6-week period, over 50% increase in hand hygiene compliance, which was very interesting because my idea of doing it over there was based on the fact that if you're in a healthcare system that is quite different than what we have in the U.S., and often patients have to wait to get a hospital bed, would they be able to do this? And, again, we found that the percentages were equally high. We then took our model to rehab, and the reason for that is that we wanted to see in a population in which people are dependent on their activities of daily living, be it eating, dressing, walking, would they challenge, as some people call this, I like to say empower rather than challenge, their healthcare worker, and we found that, again, there was over a 50% increase. And in this study, we conducted this over 18 months in which we did 6 weeks of giving out materials for empowerment, taking the materials back, and then just monitoring what was going on. And we found, again, there was a sustained compliance. We then took the model to long-term care, and we looked at three nursing homes that were operated by the Genesis system of healthcare, and we found that we had an increase in compliance, and in fact, in one of the sites, there were 90 less infections in 6 months. With the long-term care, we put a little more emphasis on empowering the healthcare worker rather than the patient. Our most recent validation, that we like to call it a validation, is in ICU. And this stems from the fact that our previous studies, people would always ask us, what do you do when patients can't speak? And prior to this study, we would say that we would encourage the families to take an active part. But I truly believe that in the ICU setting, families aren't ready to also be put in a position to do this, except in the pediatrics and neonatal. I think if all families were as vigilant as those that we see with the neonates, we probably would have better compliance across the board. But in our ICU, we just had a simple system in which we put a speaker on the floor, in the nurse, on the wall in the nurse's unit on this 16-bed medical ICU in a community hospital. And we had people of authority that we call them, the medical director of the unit, the director of nursing, the ICP, and the nurse manager, to record about 15 different messages like, we want 100% compliance, gloves do not replace hand hygiene, the use of sanitizer, don't forget before and after patient contact. These messages were played at the nurse's station randomly between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m., anywhere between 0 and 15 minutes. The question always comes up, did it bother the healthcare workers? Of course, in the very beginning, it did. Did they turn off the messages? No, they didn't turn off the messages, even though we showed them where they could turn the messages off. And the reason, remember I said in the beginning, this was done, the messages are recorded by people with authority. So these people were in the unit. They were expecting to hear these messages. And, in fact, the medical director loved to hear himself and the messages, so no one would turn the messages off. What we found in this unit is they actually had over 100% increase in sanitizer usage. Now, you're probably sitting there and saying, well, this is excellent. Well, this unit, when we began, they were only doing hand hygiene 23 times when there was a patient in the bed in a 24-hour period, which is very low. We'll show you this from our data on our measurement program. When we introduced this, they actually doubled it, but they were still less than half of where they should be. So this was, however, in a six-week period, and we were able to increase their compliance by simply encouraging empowerment through the healthcare worker. Some of the side things that we saw from this study is that families noted to the healthcare providers in that unit that they were very impressed by the amount of hand hygiene that occurred. That's the first thing that was, a secondary outcome. And then the other outcome was that patients, as they're coming to and being brought into a step-down unit, they were hearing these messages so that when they went to the step-down unit, they were more inclined to ask. And this article was in the American Journal of Infection Control in the fall of 2006. So if we look at our entire database, if you recall all the sites that were on that map, we keep track of these. And I share with you on this our data that we're in the process of now publishing, but this is one of the tables, is that what effect does empowerment have on hand hygiene compliance? And what we're able to determine that by a 10-month period, there's close to 46, the mean increase is close to 46%. It is significant at the P.001 level. And what we found, which is really important in our minds, is that there's no evidence against the intervention being equally successful in all hospital sizes and unit types. Bottom line is empowerment works in all unit types and in all types of hospitals. On slide 12, this is a slide that if you're going to do empowerment, you know, or any intervention, you have to keep in mind is that you need to pull together all your resources. It's not just the ICP or nursing. Everyone has to be part of this process if you're going to empower your patients. I think, you know, we're in the golden age for empowerment plans to work. We have National Patient Safety Goal 13 telling us we should be doing something. There's research out there, ours and others, showing that empowerment works. And the consumer. Consumers want to be empowered. Materials to empower these patients. You know, we often get caught up in let's give a lot out, let's give all these materials. We have to keep them simple and direct. Just ask the patient what you want them to do. We've come up with two schools of thought, and I like to say that Partners in Your Care, which I developed and authored while at the University of Pennsylvania, you know, has now graduated, you know, and we're on to a different phase. And between 1997 and 2007, the materials in that brochure were relevant to what we were doing because we were trying to just solely empower the patient. We've now moved on, and in 2007 began to realize that we have to see this as a team. We have to empower both the patient and the healthcare worker. So we've come out with what we refer to in empowerment as all for one. And by that we mean one patient, one healthcare worker, and one question, did you wash or sanitize your hands? This is the new version of empowerment that we think, you know, healthcare workers should consider. We also are staying with our fuzzy weevils. People seem to like that. And what we're including in our program now and going down is some type of visual reminder that patients can be given when they're in the hospital so that when they're discharged, they can be thinking about things. And it's a little wallet-type insurance card that we have seven things that patients should remember, like if they were diagnosed with MRSA, they should tell their healthcare workers. If they have an infection, you know, we talk about informed consent, about hand hygiene. There's seven basic facts that we think consumers should be aware of before they become hospitalized or while they're hospitalized. So when you implement a patient empowerment program, one of the key things is you have to make sure that people are getting the materials and that they're reading them. As part of our process, the first thing that you have to do is decide the best way to get materials to patients. And there are various ways that hospitals come up and ICPs come up with these ideas, be it pre-admission, volunteers, students. We have one site in our hospital that I think it's a brilliant, in our program, that's a brilliant idea. Their institution makes housekeeping rounds every morning. Someone goes into each patient's room and asks them, is everything okay from a housekeeping standpoint? And she has trained those people to give out the brochures. After they ask that question, they then say, okay, we would like you to be part of our program of increasing hand hygiene. Here's some materials. Here's your visual reminder. We want you to be part of this. Please remind us to wash our hands. And that's an easy way to make sure that everyone is getting the materials. So the other way that you monitor to make sure that this is happening is we have as part of our program what we like to call a patient satisfaction type form, and it asks seven simple questions that we encourage patients to fill out at the time of discharge. This can be done when the discharge papers are given out, any way that you think, you know, you can get this information. And it simply asks, you know, did you read the pamphlet? Did you ask anyone? Were you comfortable asking? How did they respond? So that gives you, as the ICP, some information or follow-up that your process that you put in place is working. So if we look at all the data so far on empowerment that's been published related to hand hygiene, the sources, the National Patient Safety Agency, which is part of the National Health System, they have been tracking this. What we find out is most patients, this is the darker part of the bigger part of your circle on page 17 or slide 17, most patients believe they should be involved in hand hygiene, and the numbers for the other side are less than 30% say that they do not want to be involved. And that more or less fits in with the MSNBC survey, the results that have come back. So once we empower our patients, and that's one form of intervention, and many of our sites use that as part of their intervention, but use various other ways. be it other programs that have posters, videos, but we believe that, you know, patient empowerment has to be part of it. Once we empower, as slide 18 says, we have to measure. You know, you have to know your direction, where you're going. Policies and guidelines will not increase hand hygiene unless you measure and you give feedback. Slide 19, what do we know about measurement programs? There was an excellent article in Journal of Hospital Infection, June of 2007, by Haas and Larson on measurement methods. And they identified several, but the three most common that we refer to are direct observation, healthcare worker self-reporting, and product volume usage. I also want to point out that you're aware of the fact that the Joint Commission is working on a monograph that will be coming out in April in which they will identify several methods. They're not going to tell us what methods to use, but they're going to identify certain methods that fall into various categories, and ICPs will have a good reference points to either look at the methods or call other ICPs in terms of how these methods are working. This is a table that is from that article, and I have highlighted four of the measurement techniques. We look at direct observation, and, you know, we're used to saying this is the gold standard, and I think we say it's the gold standard because it should be measuring everything, a technique, when it's done. The problem is we don't have a standard way. Some people say they do observation, and they do observation to focus on frequency, others on technique. So if we look at 10 people's information from observation, we may be having 10 different methodologies. So although it's a gold standard in the sense of what it's measuring or can measure, it's really not a gold standard in terms of truly being evidence-based and having a standard methodology. In addition to that, it's time-consuming. There's bias. We do not have complete 24/7 monitoring. Remote observation is another alternative. However, that can be costly, labor-intensive. It's less subject to bias, but, you know, there are problems related to that, and I think one of the biggest ones is the cost. Self-reporting, definitely low cost, but involves healthcare workers' self-awareness of hand hygiene behavior, and there have been several studies out there that have shown there's poor validity in some of these studies. So it leads us to product volume use per patient day. Again, this is less costly to monitor. It's an overall measure of use, not subject to selection bias. However, it does not provide us with hand hygiene techniques, who's doing it, whether they're doing it before and after. So you have to be comfortable that what you're measuring in product usage volume, and that's the methodology that we use, is telling you what your overall compliance is. I'd like to point out that in Belgium, they had a study, a two-year study, or phase of increasing hand hygiene compliance. And they had two phases. The first year was just do it, and the second year, do it right. And that's how we see product volume. Product volume is we want to get as many people as possible to the sink practicing hand hygiene, and then we say observation should come in to then look for the techniques and the various things that you can't measure with product volume. But to use observation as your main tool, you're often observing those people that are already practicing hand hygiene. So product volume measurement, we often get this question from ICPs, well, is this recognized? It's been referenced by the National Patient Safety Goals, CDC, WHO guidelines, IHI bundle, and we hope to be included in the Joint Commission monograph. You know, we were, you know, asked for additional information, and we will know probably in April. But they are definitely looking at product volume as a methodology. So how does it work? It's very simple, and we have a lot of this information on our website, which you can go to in terms of specifics of the program. But briefly, it's very simple. We just ask you to track your hand hygiene compliance through the measurement of product usage. This data can be sent to us either through environmental service data or through monitors. And when we say monitors, whomever you decide in your institution is basically going to save empty containers for you report this information to the ICP, and that gets sent to us. We have a simple form that we use that ICP is on the left-hand side on this page. You send us demographics on your institution. You tell us how much soap, sanitizer, and lotion you use, your bed days, what unit it's being done on, and this information is sent via email, fax, and some people just plain mail it to us. You send this data to us by the 15th of the month, and no later than the 22nd of each month, you get a complete report. And each report that you get for every unit in your hospital, so if you have 10 units in your hospital, you will get a report that has the following information for each unit. So that's important. It's given to you in a standard PDF file, and what we report to you are hand hygiene per bed day for soap, for sanitizer, combined, which is your total hand hygiene rate. We give you a mean, a percentile, benchmark, and goals, and a chart form and graph, and I'll go through these now. Your report looks like this. The name of your hospital is put on there and whatever month. And this is a report that you can print out and you can send. Some hospitals are using it to give to their board of directors, their trustees. You can email each section of the report to your unit. And in that report, we talk about benchmarking. So how do we get to the benchmarking? This is frequently asked of us. You know, how have we established benchmarking and goals? The benchmarks, and this is on slide 28, the benchmarks are calculated using data from every hospital and unit in the program. We use a linear regression, and the percentile benchmarks are drawn from the same model using intervals calculated at the 10th and 90th percentile. So we tell you where in our database the 10th percentile is, the 90th plus the mean. Comparative benchmarks are drawn at the average overall comparable units and at the 10th and the 9th percentile, which means we compare you with hospitals of your own size in terms of bed. You know, if you're a 300-bed hospital, you're compared with 300-bed hospitals. If you're 25, with a 25. And we also compare them by the type of unit, ICU, non-ICU, pediatrics, long-term care, rehab, and outpatient units. So your data is really, you know, specific to your hospital, but also benchmark to hospitals similar to yours. Our compliance goals, how have we established them? Various ways, based on the literature, and we have at our website the literature that we're using to get these numbers. We also confirm it by observational studies. We have some sites out there that have done observation for us, and we have arrived at what we consider a reasonable compliance goal at this point. For ICU, we're saying that your compliance goal should be hand hygiene should occur 144 times in a 24-hour period when there's a patient in the bed, non-ICU 72, pediatrics 72, ER outpatient 6 hand hygienes per patient visit, clinics 3, and rehab long-term care 20. So this is what you report that you get back from us. This is a hospital, okay? It falls into the category of 100 to 300 beds. This is an ICU unit. This is their report for soap. On the left-hand side, that's hand hygiene per bed day. On the bottom, intervention period. So 0 is baseline, 5 is 5 months, 10, 15, and 20. So you can see for this hospital, the mean, they are below the mean on several months. At their fifth month, they got to the mean, and then they dropped down, and they're gradually coming back up. This is the same hospital for their sanitizer usage for the ICU. And again, you can see at the fifth month, they began to really get into this, and for some reason, it slid down. And you can see as the ICP, you then have this document to go to the ICU and say to them, you know, look, we've been monitoring this, you've been going up, what happened at month, you know, 7? There has to be a problem, let's look into this. And this is where then you can go as an ICP to the team there and say, I'm going to do some observation to see why this happened. I truly believe that observation works when it's a team effect. Secret shoppers and, you know, doing all these things, you know, it has to be a team thing, because if not, it's perceived as a management thing. You want to see yourself as part of this team. This is the same hospital. So we look at their overall compliance goal. Okay, this is for a 100 to 300 bed. This is a non-ICU. You can see for this hospital, they did come to the mean, but they're sliding below the 10th percentile. So, you know, they need to have some work in this. Your report for every unit will also give you a bar graph. We find that some of our sites like to use this as educational tools. They hand this out and they follow, you know, over time. We then find that some of our sites would prefer just having the data, so we include this for every site. You will get a running list each month of how you're doing. So this is their for a hospital that's been in the program for 14 months, baseline, you can see their various rates. And on the end, we put their compliance goal. So you can see for this hospital, they started out, their compliance was 7.6%. They gradually came along. By the time they got to intervention 6, they were really coming along. They dropped down. Remember I showed you that dip? And they're coming up again. You may be looking at 7.6 and say, wow, this is really bad, but I can tell you that most of our sites who join the program, they come in under 20% compliance at baseline. And for some ICPs who have been doing observation and reporting 90%, they need to be prepared to justify, you know, why this compliance is lower. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they weren't doing a good job, but also reflecting that observation does not capture what's happening 24 hours a day. So this unit demonstrates good progress. Okay, you can see at about the 5th month, they are hovering near the mean, and this is on slide 35. However, the solid red line, that's where they should be. Okay, so they're working towards that, and they will get to it. We can tell you that by the time people are in our program, 18 months, a year to 18 months, they do reach these goals. This unit needs a boost. You can see on this slide, okay, they're below the 10th percentile, okay, below that green line. For the next slide, okay, slide 37, we find this often in ICUs. When the ICUs take our data, you know, that baseline, and they go to that unit and show them, there is a faster increase to that compliance goal, okay, of that solid red line with our ICUs than non-ICUs. I think when ICU people visually see where they are and where they should be, it gives a boost to in compliance. So we have these reports. We now know, and in fact, there was a study reported at Shea in 2007 in which they looked at the idea of using monthly reports for staff, CEO, committee, and boards. And, you know, what they found is they have various interventions in their hand hygiene program, but the one intervention that was most effective in having them achieve their hand hygiene goal was making sure that reports were given back to the leaders and the healthcare workers with their specific unit data. And that's what we do. Every report, you can just, as I said, go to whatever unit and just email that section to the person on that unit so they can follow it. What about observation? I'm not against observation, but my philosophy has always been compliance first, observation second. Get your compliance up by using a standardized methodology, okay, that can measure what's going on in your hospital 24/7, and then do observation. We know that observations have never been evaluated for accuracy, and in fact, these authors looked at in the AJIC article 2006, and it really what observation does is it really capture about 3%, and some people even say less than 1% of what is actually going on. So if we look at volume measurement versus observation, what are the pros and cons? Because often ICPs need to address these. Observation, we know, is resource intensive. Product volume, when one starts a product volume program, it takes about 16 hours as startup time. That means mobilizing your forces, you know, getting everyone on board, having the meetings. Ongoing for the ICP, it's about 1 to 2 hours a month. Okay, 1 to 2 hours a month. That's to fill out our forms, send it to us, get back your reports, and review them. Observation, the staff recognizes the auditors and change behavior. You know, you don't have that in product volume. Events are not only observable. For all of us who have ever done infection control, we know that observation, it's often hard to observe what's going on. Product volume, you don't have to address this. Additional time and cost for observation, it is. You know, we've calculated that even the most minimum form of observation takes, you know, at least 50% more than it's going to cost to do product volume. Observation is often perceived as a management thing. You know, it's something management wants. You know, it really doesn't reflect this. And often with observation, when you present your data to the healthcare worker on a particular unit or a floor, you know, the response often is, well, it was a bad day. We really do hand hygiene. You're really not capturing what's happening. And, you know, you're hard-pressed to really say, well, I know this is what is happening. Whereas product volume, you do have documentation. Observation increases compliance, is evidence-based. You know, we believe that product volume is an evidence-based methodology. Proven to sustain, we have shown in our studies that you can sustain compliance using product volume. And benchmarking capabilities, product volume does have that ability to do it. So if we pull all of what I've said together, you know, what should the ICP be doing if they're starting a program that includes empowerment and measurement? First, get support. You need to get support from everyone on your team. It's easier to get support from the top than, you know, be down at the bottom trying to go up. Make sure products are available. You need to make sure that your dispensers are filled, that you have products that, you know, people are going to want to use. You know, the best program is going to fail if they're using products that, you know, are making the hands significantly irritated or whatever the problems might be. So you need to evaluate that. Provide educational materials. Use empowerment. You need to use patient empowerment in your program. Monitor compliance. Provide feedback to the healthcare worker. And then observe after compliance has increased. So, you know, since 2003, half the states have passed infection reporting and control laws. Now, this is from Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And you can see, this is on slide 43, I'm sure you can see them I don't know if you can see them in color, but there are very few states that have no action at all right now. So we're into this mandatory reporting of hospital-acquired infection. What I believe, and I think ICPs have to get out there and really get this message across, mandatory hospital-acquired infection rates and hand hygiene compliance rates. You know, I'm not advocating another activity for ICPs, but how I see this, if we are to see the value of mandatory reporting on our healthcare system, we must include rates for the significant predisposing factor for all hospital-acquired infections, and that's hand hygiene. When I first started doing infection control and surveillance, hand hygiene rates without hospital-acquired infection rates without hand hygiene rates can be compared to our first attempts at surveillance. When I started doing surveillance, we would just report UTIs, respiratory tract infections, and then we said, well, these are related to predisposing factors, so then we said, how many people are in catheters? We've now gotten to the point of catheter days, VAC days, but the single most important predisposing factor to all hospital-acquired infection rates, we don't require to be part of this mandatory reporting. We need to put these together to make some sense if we're going to move forward. A hospital that has a high hospital-acquired infection rate and a low hand hygiene compliance, if they see this, there's room for improvement. Okay, thank you, and I hope we can have some questions or some challenges or something I might be able to clarify for you. I think we have a little over 15 minutes to address some of them. I wanted to leave some time, you know, for this.
Thank you very much for that, Dr. McGuckin. That was fascinating, and some of the responses that you've had and the successes. I wonder how much of initial positive responses can be attributable to, somewhat to a Hawthorne effect, because they know that you're watching.
Well, I think what observation, I mean, I think that's what you have, you know, in terms of, you know, patient empowerment, you know, you're not really in the room on whether the patient is asking or not. And what we're doing is measuring whether that has some effect to our product volume. Through product volume, you know, initially, it's pretty hard to look at the Hawthorne effect with product volume, because we're just basically, you know, saving empty containers. And over the 10 years, we have never had reports of people saying, well, people are going in just trying to empty dispensers, and so we have empty containers. So we don't see that. So I think the Hawthorne effect you see more often with observation.
Interesting. Thank you.
I was wondering who did the dialogue with the patient, because my thoughts are if an ICP did the dialogue with the patient, it may not be as effective as if their frontline healthcare provider did the dialogue with the patient, saying that they didn't mind if they asked them. And I just wondered if they had that. And also, could you list some of the interventions that you did to increase from your baseline to, you've got interventions 1 through 14?
Okay. The first part of your question, we leave it, the sites who enroll in our program, we leave it to the sites how they want to get the dialogue going with the patient. As I said, some sites use pre-admission people. Some use, as I said, the housekeeping people. Some use students. Some use the nurse who does the initial nursing assessment. You know, it depends on what works for their hospital. We actually discourage ICPs and trying to give ICPs another job to do, that they have to go in and visit every patient. It should be more somehow when you feel most of the patients are going to be encountered in some type of setting. As far as the intervention, you know, for the data that we showed here, where I showed periods 1 through 10 and the median percent increase, the intervention that was used there was 100% patient empowerment. That's what we were measuring. We were measuring all sites enrolled in the measurement program were using patient empowerment only as their primary intervention. Now, they may have had some posters around. We didn't control for that. But they gave out our brochures, and they were also using a visual reminder. And in those sites, it was the fuzzy weevil or some other visual reminder.
So I was wondering, in slide number 29, compliance goals, it says ICU is got to have at least a minimum of 144 hand hygiene per patient for a 24-hour period. Is that right?
Yes.
Yes. So I was wondering how you got those numbers, and does that include isolated or just routine practice patients? And, I mean, how does it go? Can you just talk a bit about that, please?
Yeah. 144 obviously comes to a 6 an hour, okay? And there have been, as I said, on our website, we have all the references that we used for this. Again, there were some in the literature and also some where we actually did observations in ICUs. And it included most of the information from the literature was non-isolated patients. So, you know, we found that, you know, if you look at all the studies, most people come somewhere between, I would say, 6 and 10 an hour. And obviously during the day shift, you're going to have more than 6 an hour, and at night you're probably going to have less. So it sort of averages out to that. I might add, we would be glad to answer your questions, and I'm sure some of your questions will probably be answered on our website. If you go to it, we have an extensive reference list there. And we also have the references for the research and our compliance goals. So there's several educational pieces on there that will probably give you a little more information that's hard to get across in, you know, 45 minutes.
Great. Thank you very much. thank you all for joining me on this teleclass today. A special thanks to our faculty, Dr. Marianne McGuckin, for a really fascinating presentation. Marianne, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thank you to all my colleagues out there.
We'll talk again very soon, and until then, goodbye.